Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday. I'm really confused about days today. May 13th, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government and opening a public hearing on House Bill 5035 related to the Department of Revenue. Mr. Borden.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. The Department of Revenue is picking up this and concluding the second day of its overview of its revenue management and collection activities that was requested by the subcommittee. The agency is going to give a very, very brief overview of when they were here last, which was on April 29th, and so that presentation is still out on April 29th. And the presentation for today is just where they're picking up with that and going to finish up. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Buchholz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Buchholz, Director of your Department of Revenue. And as John said, this is day two of phase two, or actually day three of phase two for the Department of Revenue, but it's day two of the revenue management discussion that we had. I think you probably remember that we started out last time and we talked about the LFO liquidated and delinquent report and the reporting that revenue had to do with that and how revenue had about one quarter of the total debt that was of the total state debt that was reported in that report. We talked about our other agency accounts function at length, Deanna did, and then we also talked about the enforcement revenue relationship to the accounts receivable and collections. In other words, how we populate the accounts receivable that we collect for tax debt purposes. And today, we hope to wrap up that discussion. I'm going to begin by giving you a 40,000-foot overview of a year in the life of Department of Revenue, and I'm going to try to clear up some confusion about a couple of high-level concepts related to tax administration. Next, Deanna is going to unpack for you the tools that we have that you've given us to go about collecting delinquent debt. Steve Bouchard, our collection section manager, will describe for you some of the recent changes he's implemented to improve our business, and then I'll wrap up with a discussion of how you might be able to help us as we convert to the new tools that you've authorized with the Gentax system. So the first slide here, I think there's been some confusion between the LFO liquidated and delinquent balance and the tax gap, and I wanted to take a couple of minutes to explain how they're different and how they relate. First, let me point out that the data in this slide comes from our automated collection tracking system, so it includes all of our tax debt, some of which is exempt from reporting in the LFO report. So don't be alarmed that the numbers here don't match up exactly to that report. It comes from a different source. But to the slide, this is a high-level, simplified view of a single year in our income tax system. The blue part of the diagram that you see there represents all of the timely and voluntarily paid receipts, income tax receipts. The red part represents the delinquent payments, and that's for the most part our enforcement activities. And the gray part represents the tax gap, and I'll explain that in a little bit more detail in a minute. I want to tell you that the blue and the red portions of the diagram represent actual numbers from 2014. The tax gap is off to the side because it's not an actual number. It's an estimate. And the actual number is really unknowable. It's an estimate. And you'll note that it's an estimate from 2010. And that's because we don't have the data. It was taken from a study report that we gave to this committee last year. We don't have the data to estimate for 2014 yet. So we're using the 2010 number.
But, Mr. Buchholz, if I may, 2010, we were still barely into our recovery in Oregon, so 2010 are the most recent data that we have that we could use to repair. I mean, because that strikes me that it might be a lot lower, unless you think that it's actually potentially. I mean, that number might be a lot larger, unless you think it's going to be smaller because people are actually paying their taxes because they can afford to.
Madam Chair, I think that actually the number for the tax gap for the more recent years might even be bigger, and it's because of the estimation methodology, and I'll get into that in a couple of minutes.
Thank you. We
almost certainly could do 2011 for you, and we might even have enough information for 2012 if that's important. We wouldn't be able to meet that 48-hour requirement, though, because it takes our research department some machinations in order to get it. But really, it's just here for order of magnitude.
Okay.
It's a big
that's
number.
That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll take that. Thank you. Lots of zeros.
So the tax gap is defined.
Hey, Madam Chair, not enough yet.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
The tax gap is defined as the difference between what would be paid if 100% of taxpayers filed accurately and paid 100% of what's due and what's actually paid and collected. And there are three main components to an income tax gap. There's a non-filing gap. This is tax due from taxpayers who don't file timely. There's an underpayment gap, and this is tax due from taxpayers who don't pay timely. And then lastly, there's an underreporting gap. This is tax due from taxpayers who file and pay timely, but who underreport the taxes due, either through overstating deductions or understating income. And as I said, the 2010 tax gap is at $1.2 billion. And so why is that number so high? To answer that, I think it's helpful to understand how the estimate was derived, because it'll help you to understand why this is such a big challenge for us, and not just a challenge for us, but a challenge for the IRS and a challenge for every other state and really every other jurisdiction worldwide that has an income tax. The tax gap is a big deal for all of us, and we've touched on this in this committee before. We didn't actually do an independent study to come up with this number. We leveraged work done by the IRS in the early 2000s, and we simply used these IRS estimates, and applied them to Oregon. So one of the assumptions that we had to make was that Oregon's tax gap was identical to the IRS's tax gap in all other states, because they did it on a nationwide basis. They didn't parse it down for Oregon. And here's how the IRS came up with their estimate. Based on a random sample of filed returns and estimates of true liability for these returns. So they randomly selected a bunch of returns and estimated what they thought the true liability was for those returns that they estimated. They did a comprehensive audit of each of those selective returns. And then they adjusted whatever misreporting they found in the audit by multiplying the understatement by a factor. And that factor was to account for income that taxpayers didn't report and that remained undetected after the audit. And that multiplication factor for low visibility income items ranged for the items in that IRS study ranged between 3.3 to 4.2. And so what that means is that if the IRS audited a return and found a $100 understatement, the IRS estimated the actual understatement to be between $330 to $420. So that's how they came up with that estimate for the tax gap. And what this is recognizing is the fact that the income tax system relies on taxpayers self-reporting their income. And it means that if the estimate is correct, that if we were somehow able to audit every single Oregonian and collect 100% of what was understated, the estimate methodology says we'd reduce the gap by about one-third. So it's stuff that remains after the ability to audit. Approximately 80% of the total tax gap comes from underreporting tax due. So. And the vast majority of this comes from low visibility income items. For example, the gap for W-2 wages is estimated at only 1.3%. And it's so low because the third-party reporting requirement makes W-2 wages highly visible. Everybody knows what's on that W-2. In contrast, the gap for small business income is estimated by the IRS to be in excess of 50%.
Wow.
Huge, right? And it's because there's no way to establish third-party reporting for small business sales. It's easier for them to underreport this income. So until we can find a way to either physically or virtually place a DOR agent or an IRS agent at every single small business cash register to capture not only the sales that get recorded, but also the cash sales, to log the cash sales that bypass the taxpayer's records altogether, there will be a tax gap. The income tax season.
I'm voting no on that. On that recommendation.
You and me both, Mr. Co-Chair. You and me both.
So the $534 million that you see in that big red arrow in the center, that comes mostly from DOR enforcement work that reduces the gap from what it otherwise would be. So that's our business. And it feeds into the DOR tax debt accounts receivable that you see, that box right below it, that's available for collection. And in the that accounts receivable is DOR's approximately one-quarter portion of the statewide total debt, the $3.2 billion that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. So the DOR accounts receivable comes from that portion of the overall gap that we're able to discover and bill for, but it's not the same as the tax gap.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Just, I guess, kind of a commentary here. You know, I think the Department of Revenue is in kind of an awkward situation because on the one hand, you have the legislature pounding on them to collect more revenue. On the other hand, we're pounding on the Department of Revenue to not harass small business and to harass mom and pop in their home. And so, I mean, it's a fine line you're walking here.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, you're absolutely right, and I take it a step further because the gap is not all scofflaws, right? There is a significant portion of that gap that is inadvertent. Right. Taxpayers who are trying to do the right thing and simply miss the mark. Right. And as an example of that, or as evidence of that, I mentioned to you in phase one about the unit that we have that processes returns and makes adjustments on the face. About one out of every $3 that we adjusted for was in the taxpayer's favor. And so complexity makes it difficult. The complexity of the system makes it difficult for taxpayers to file correctly. And if taxpayers make mistakes that aren't in their favor, that has to be inadvertence, right? And it has to be because of the complexity. And if there's a certain percentage of the taxpayers that are making mistakes that aren't in their favor, there's probably a percentage of taxpayers that are making mistakes in their favor. And it's just inadvertent because of the complexity of the system. So we can't aggressively, I would say, go after taxpayers, assuming that they're all scofflaws. Right, deliberate. We have to assume that they're trying to do the right thing, and then, but through use of the tools, collect the dollars that are owed. So that's a good observation. So I think. Deanna is here to walk you through the tools that you've given us to collect on delinquent debt, but I wanted to say before...
Sorry, excuse me, Mr. Buchholz, Senator Winsett.
Thank you. Mr. Buchholz, it's my understanding that the Department of Revenue has recently changed from reporting accounts receivable on the basis of accounts to liabilities. And as I understand, the account is all of the liabilities owned by a particular individual or entity, and the liability is divided up into each different debt. And when I was reading through this material, I know legislative fiscal is having a difficult time making the numbers work on when you report out as liabilities. So I wonder why you made that change.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I didn't know that we made a change. I do know that there is a difference. I didn't know that we made a change in the way that we were reporting. I thought we were reporting the same way.
Well, perhaps I could be, Mr. Borden, has the reporting remained the same all the way through?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I will do some checking on that. I am not sure. Usually it's reported both ways, I thought, in the report, but I will verify that and get back to the subcommittee.
Thank you. The second question, on your Oregon Department of Revenue Income Tax Programs Accounts Receivable 2014 document, it shows that the one that I was particularly interested in is the growth of the accounts receivables from year to year. Mm-hmm. And prior to 2010, you had $217 million, added $49 million in 2010, $88 in 2011, $112 million in 2012, and then it jumped to $225 in 2013 and then fell to $130 in 2014. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some idea of what's going on there? I don't understand the drop off in 14, or unless it perhaps they have not liquidated yet, and are the 12 and 13, is that they're still in the collection process? What caused that big spike in the drop off?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the Accounts receivable balance was pretty flat. It was around $500 million a year for the 3 or 4 years prior to the advent of the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. So I think in 2008 was when it started to rise. And I mentioned in here before that the initial increase to our tax debt accounts receivable came from self-assessed. So these were taxpayers that had some life event happen to them where somebody lost their job maybe and they got to tax time and they weren't able to reconcile, but they wanted to comply, and so they filed their return saying, yes, we owe this debt, and Department of Revenue work with us on collecting the debt. That's the first couple of years, and we saw quite an increase from that. Over the next couple of years, what we started seeing more was the other shoe, and these were taxpayers that likely were in the same life circumstances where somebody lost their job, but they got to tax time and they looked at it and they saw, oh, I can't pay this debt, and so I'm not even going to file. And so it takes us a couple of years longer to catch up to the people who aren't filing. And so the biggest increase to our accounts receivable over those couple of years was the filing enforcement debt that we were adding to it. I think what you're seeing in 2014, part of it is probably the economy catching up. But remember, there's a large component of that where you had given us resource at the beginning of the year, at the end of the 13th session, to work our debt, to cancel and write off debt, because we hadn't done that in quite a few years. And so there was a pretty significant effort to write off and cancel debt that wasn't collectible. And so I think what you're seeing there, at least the big portion of why it dropped from 2014, is we were finally addressing some of that delinquent debt, or that uncollectible delinquent debt that it had been a number of years since we had addressed.
So the roughly doubling between 2012 and 2013 from 112 to 225 is identifying people that hadn't, $115 million people who hadn't filed.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, it's a mix, right? There are audits that we're doing all along. There are self-assessed taxpayers every year that find that they owe a debt and they can't pay it, but they file anyway. And there are taxpayers who aren't filing, and we have to pursue through our filing enforcement activity. What I'm saying is the largest portion at the beginning of the recession was the biggest contributor was self-assessed, and the biggest contributor over the last couple of years has been that filing enforcement activity.
Actually, I think probably the reason the drop off in 2014 is actually 130,000, not 130 million. And my guess is that you didn't simply haven't applied the debt because this came out before the fiscal year was finished. Otherwise, yes. You dropped off from 225 million to 130,000.
Well, actually, I think we started out the 2014 year with 874 million due in personal income tax, corp, and withholding, and we ended the year with 857 million.
So what you're saying is you aggressively wrote off $200 million?
No, that's a combination of collections and write-off.
Thank you.
Okay. As I said, Deanna's here. She's going to walk you through the tools that you've given us for collecting debt. But I wanted to say, to start out with, that at the highest level, our approach to collecting debt is that if a taxpayer owes a debt, and after allowing for reasonable living expenses, if we believe that they have the means to pay the debt, then we use the full weight of these enforcement tools to collect on that debt. If the taxpayer doesn't have sufficient income after allowing for their reasonable living expenses, then we'll set that debt aside for a while and come back and check on it periodically. And if we find that circumstances have changed for the taxpayer and now they have the ability to pay the debt, then we resume the use of the tools. And if the taxpayer never demonstrates that they have the ability to pay that debt off after the better part of a decade, then it becomes a candidate for write-off. And so I...
Sorry, before Ms. Mack starts, Mr. Co-Chair.
Back on the other side.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry about that. Sorry. I'm assuming our collection folks have a little bit of latitude to work with the debtor.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, yes, they do.
Okay. And so if a person is owing the state of Oregon money, but they're willing to work with the state, I'm hoping that we're trying to work with them as well.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we are, and Deanna, I think, is going to touch on that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. I just want to make sure there's that. It's a fine line you walk here, that there's a balance in, yes, trying to collect the revenue, but at the same time, doing it in a manner that is appropriate, I guess.
Yes.
I don't know what appropriate the definition is, but appropriate.
Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And this slide here, you guys asked us to discuss our strategies relating to how we currently collect the debt, including what's related to private collection firms, as well as to cover our write-off cancellation and abatement policy. So I'm going to cover all that in the next few slides. The first area here, this blue area of the slide, is where the debt is becoming liquid and delinquent. So are the required notices are being mailed, the taxpayer can self-resolve.
Sorry, this is one of my one-on-one questions. I apologize. Can you define liquid in this context, please? I know you've done it before, but I'm still learning your language.
Right. Liquid and delinquent. Delinquent is where the debt is more than 30 days old, and liquid is where the debt is assessed, and we have, generally, there's no appeal right left on the tax, on the amount owing. It's exact, it's stated, it's... The taxpayer's been notified of it. They're aware of it. That's what liquid would be.
Madam Chair, if I can jump in.
Please.
Remember that in tax debt, there's always an appeal right. There is virtually always an appeal right. So there are normal appeal rights that the taxpayer should meet. Mm-hmm. But after the fact, if we find out that the liability is highly doubtful for whatever reason, then we'll use that statute to reduce the debt. So it's liquid in one sense, but it's never really liquid when you're talking about tax debt.
Liquid is after they've done their normal appeal stuff.
Correct.
And despite their protestations to the contrary, ultimately there's some judgment that, yes, this is the right amount of debt, and that's what you're going to move forward with. If you move forward with that and then down the road something dramatic happens and it becomes clear that there's new evidence that suggests the debt is higher or lower?
Yes. Well, no, excuse me.
Lower.
No, lower.
Lower.
We only work one way.
So you
can't. Gate swings one way.
Okay.
Right.
So for some reason something happens and it becomes clear the debt is lower, then that can be reopened and the taxpayer can appeal again.
Well, we would abate. Madam Chair, we would abate if we come to an agreement that the amount, during the dispute, we would abate if they win or they have the right answer as opposed to us if it's a legal issue. We would just take away the amount that they owed, and if there's an overpayment, we would just refund it to them if they have paid too much.
But I guess the question is, how does it come to your attention then if the taxpayer can't appeal again? Say they said, I did this thing that was this huge expense and it's a deductible expense, but they can't find the receipt for it, and they do everything, and then somehow a year later their spouse empties out a box and discovers there's the receipt and it shows that they really did do that. And
Madam Chair, we typically won't adjust for those.
Okay.
We won't adjust for those.
If you do crummy record keeping, that's on you.
What this is typically used for is oftentimes taxpayers don't respond to our notices.
Uh-huh.
So we'll send a notice saying, we think you owe this, and tell us if that's wrong, and they'll set it in the pile with all of their other bills or whatever, and until it hardens. And then even then they don't respond to our notices, and it's when we begin garnishing or use one of these more aggressive techniques for collecting the debt, all of a sudden we get their attention and they say, well, I don't really owe this. Mm-hmm. And then we can work with them on that.
Got it. Thank you. And that process generally happens within the first 3 months of an assessment being issued. The green area there is anywhere from 3 to 12 months in our timeline, and that's where we start really actively collecting on the debt. And then after the yellow area there is to illustrate the considerations we have when we send a debt to a private collection firm. And I'll go over this in a lot more detail over the next few slides.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking ahead a bit at the coming slides, and this is, I think it's all on collections, but a few of the questions that have come up for me since I've been thinking about the previous time that we met together with the department, some of my questions are about how things get to this point, such as auditing and that process. Are we going to have an opportunity to talk about that today, or should I just...
On slide 13, on the very first one there that I'm going to talk about, I was going to explain how we get to that very first step.
Thank you.
Not a problem. So step one, liquid and delinquent, what that is the assessment notice is issued that triggers our ability to collect. So generally those are when a taxpayer self-assesses, they file a return saying that they owe tax. We issue a deficiency assessment because of an audit where they have underpaid and we've gone through the steps of an audit, or we have a failure to file assessment where we've requested them to file a return and they have not filed a return. And we file a return if essentially we file a return on their behalf. So we assess tax that we believe that they owe. Those are the ways that a debt gets into collections. That's the sources of them.
May I ask now about
please.
That? When I was thinking about this and talking with a couple of people about how it is we audit people, there's something that you do called an audit selection process. And one of the points that I heard is that our audit selection process is actually a set of policy choices made by the department. Who's going to be audited? And what kind of taxpayers are we auditing? And just wondering if to show that you're doing lots of audits, you're selecting audits that seem like they might be simpler and quicker to resolve, rather than doing audits on something that might be more complex, take longer, but actually the yield could be bigger.
Do you want to go ahead and go for it?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, every year our compliance section does an audit in filing enforcement resource allocation plan. And they make choices about how we're going to use our resource for the particular year. And we do exactly what you said. There are some audits that we do, and some of the activities that we do are pedal to the metal revenue generation. They're easy get in and get out and bill, and they're typically pretty easy. And we use a lot of these types of audits for our newer auditors that they're able to train on. And then we have some other, we identify particular areas that we think there's maybe an issue in that we've been seeing, and so we want to hit that hard in order to get the ripple effect from the people that we don't necessarily audit in that, but as they're telling their friends and they tell two friends and so on, we think that we do get a bump in the dollars that we collect indirectly from those audits. And the other thing, we also choose some audits that are very difficult. And probably, in many cases, the ROI doesn't pencil out for it because they're very difficult audits and they're in areas that taxpayers challenge and they're very difficult to defend on appeal. But we do those in order to maintain a presence across the board and make ourselves look bigger than we actually are. So we do have a strategy on it. It isn't all about revenue generation.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Talk to me about record retention. If someone goes through an audit process and there's not a significant rate of return, are they inclined to be reviewed again in the future? Let me tell you where I'm going with this. Let's push pause and rewind on this. If you go through, use TurboTax, you know, at the very end they have you, you know, what are your chances of being
yes.
audited? And, you know, if you meet certain criteria, it becomes high. If the Department of Revenue went through that review and came out of there and said, no, it just isn't there, but they continue to be one of those entities that would be a likely candidate. Do you have historical records to go back and say, you know, we looked at them 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and what we thought was there wasn't?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we do. It's not very sophisticated. They're typically more paper records in just what we have in front of us.
Where I'm going with this is trying to figure out that balance. Let me give you an example. Let's say someone who chooses to tithe 10% of their mm-hmm. income, and they're a high earner. And so all of a sudden, you know, on the deduction for charitable contributions, it's a very high dollar amount, mm-hmm. And that gets reviewed. And then 2 years later, they're still having that large contribution. Is there a mechanism to not go check again because it's been checked once already?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, there is. But again, it's not very sophisticated, so there is a possibility that we will audit somebody 2 or 3 years down the road for the same issue on something that wound up being a no change prior. But I would say that there have been studies on this, and economists have found that, surprisingly enough, for the person that gets audited, that there often is a decrease in voluntary compliance in the year or two after they're audited. And it didn't explain why. It may be because they think that lightning won't strike twice. I don't know. But so we don't necessarily say, okay, we audited that person 2 or 3 years ago and it had this result or that result, and so we're not going to audit them again.
There are actually psychology studies about this very phenomenon.
Is there?
And there's an analogous thing on the other side. For example, if someone does a good turn for someone earlier in the day, they're less likely to do another one later in the day because they think that there's a subconscious thing about they've already done it. So it's not quite the same, but it's basically like, here's been my interaction for this period of time, and this is how I'm going to deal with it. Like, I've done my duty to the DOR. I've done my duty to the IRS, and I don't have to do it for this. Like, I've done my good deed.
That's probably why I only let one person in.
That's exactly the analogy I was going to use, Mr. Buchholz.
Right.
So, yeah, there's actually some really interesting psychology about this. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Steiner Hayward. So that policy that you were just talking about, is that mirror the federal the IRS's policy, or is it different?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, I don't know the IRS's policy. I can't speak to that.
Follow-up.
Certainly.
My understanding is that there is some, I don't know this, but for a fact, so I'm not going to go to the mat on it, but that the feds actually do track when someone is not paying in order to see repetitive behavior, because past behavior is often indicative of future behavior. So I'm actually a little surprised to hear this,
well,
your testimony. I'm a little surprised to hear that, and I just wanted to know if you could talk to me a little bit about how that decision came to be.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, I don't know that it was really a conscious decision that we made.
Okay.
I think it goes more to the tools that we have,
okay,
and our ability to track across years with the taxpayers. I can say that one of the tools that Gentax offers for us is that audit scoring. And part of audit scoring has to be past results, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if a taxpayer passed with flying colors on an audit, then that has to be reflected in their audit score for future years, and so which would make that a lesser likelihood that we would audit that one.
Follow up,
please.
Thank you, Chair Steiner Hayward. So, let's, for example, to keep the math simple, let's say you have a year where 15% of the population that makes $100,000 to $125,000 a year doesn't pay their income tax. Whatever, say something very simple like that, and that number stays pretty much the same. Do you have the ability to look to see if that 15% that are not paying are the same people?
Currently, I don't think.
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, I don't know that we do. Currently.
Okay.
Perhaps we will with the new tools, but I don't know that we have it right now.
Because, of course, with technology, I'm sorry, follow-up. Thank you, Chair Steiner here, because obviously with technology, you'd want to be able to approach the question and look at it from different angles and to see where you can identify people, so it would be makes
Madam
make
Chair,
sense to be able to
Representative Taylor, right now our process for choosing audits is is pretty manual. We do have we do have software that we use. We use ACL software that helps us to choose our audits, but we don't have a lot of people that are skilled in using that, and so it comes down to just a few people, and so it winds up being more of a manual process for us for choosing our audits now.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair Steiner Herbert. So with the ACL, I'm glad to hear that you have that, and I'm just curious, who's deciding what the inputs are for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, it comes from program. So program people who have expertise in this and have seen particular issues, then they give them the inputs.
Thank you. What I'm saying is that when you use ACL, then you need to put in the parameters of what it is that you're searching for. The person who's using it at the time, it's like running a query. It's way more complicated, but it's like running a query. And so you put in the parameters of what it is you're looking for, and so it would be the example of people making $150,000, and you'd put those in. Someone has to put in the request for ACL. So who is deciding that when you're doing the audit selection? Are they being given, is there a policy in place? Is there a manager telling them how to do that? I mean, who's deciding what the parameters are for the search?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, that's why I was saying it comes from program. It comes from program staff.
I thought you meant a programmer.
Oh, no.
I was like, what?
I meant it comes from the individual programs, and it comes from people who have expertise and who have many years in doing this and identifying good audits. They give the parameters for the people who are working the ACL software. Then they get the results, and the experts go through that and decide which ones we're going to audit.
I guess I'm trying to understand how going forward, even with Gentax, when you're deciding who to audit, so you'll be continuing to use ACL going forward when you have the Gentax to do the audit selection?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, I don't know.
Okay, so maybe I'm missing something. Maybe someone else can help me out. I'm trying to understand how are we going to, we've spent all this money on Gentax, so how are we going to select who we're going to inquire about? I'm trying to understand how we're going to do that. I'm missing something.
May I have somebody that knows more about that?
Oh, no, that's fine. I just was curious. Maybe we can talk about it another time.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting and useful conversation, but it sounds like it requires a little bit more detail. Mr. Buchholz, that would probably be helpful, and it may be helpful if you get answers to the whole committee. Maybe you can have a conversation, or your person can have a conversation with Representative Taylor, and once we've sorted out the answers, maybe that person or you or somebody could send something to Mr. Borden that the whole committee could have access to. Does that sound like a reasonable plan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to join in on the request for a little bit of follow-up also on the audit selection process, because it occurs to me that even though I certainly understood that response, I believe the response is probably it shows that Oregon is taking a reasonable, prudent approach toward audit selection. I'm wondering, of those that we choose to do, where the return on investment may be a little iffier because it's harder, the harder cases. How can we, can you provide us information on, for example, are we auditing Schedule C, E, and F filers, and how does that compare to all the ordinary folks who you can quickly find and get either compliance or do a collections process. So I'm going to want to join in on this a little bit more in-depth follow-up.
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, I think we can get information for you on that. I think that we'll want to leave it at a fairly high level because we don't want to reveal what our roadmap is, but I think we can get you some information on the audits that we've done.
Thank you.
Great. Okay. So back to the collections overview. The step two after the debt has become liquid and delinquent is we send a notice and demand for payment. That's usually about 30 days after one of those three assessment forms that I was talking about, the self-assessment, the deficiency assessment, or the failure to file assessment. the debt at that point is lawfully owed, and I think the legislature and the DOR believe that we have an obligation and an expectation to ask for payment. So we, at that point, we ask the debtor to contact us. That at that point, we also inform the debtor of the collection process and the options for a payment plan. About 30 days later, we send what's called a distraint warrant, and that is can be recorded in the county if there's real property. It can also be filed with the Secretary of State in the UCC record if there is unencumbered personal property identified. Those are called revenue warrants there. And these are issued even if the debtor is in a payment plan. And the reason that they're issued even if they're in a debtor in a payment plan is to protect the rights of the state in the event that they break their payment plan. We have that. We can't do any collection, seizing of any assets or anything until that warrant has been issued.
Please.
So on that process, how often does that occur, the filing of those security positions, say with the Uniform Commercial Code filing with the Secretary of State?
Mr. Co-Chair, we issue a demand on every a distraint warrant on every liability. We don't often record them in the UCC database because we have had poor success with the return on them. We do record them regularly with the county.
I don't mean to interrupt you, and you have to pay a fee.
There's a filing fee for both. Both of those filing fees are passed on to the debtor under a Chapter 18 statutes. But the UCC component, I remember one particular case, they came to us and said, you're next in line to get the restaurant equipment. And we just don't have a place for it. We can't do anything with the napkins or the linens or the tables. So they haven't been particularly effective for us as a tool, the grills and the silverware. So
really quick, I don't mean to interrupt, but I hope the committee understands. So what they're saying is you can file this thing, mm-hmm. but how are you going to act on it?
Right.
And what are you going to do with a bunch of restaurant equipment if you go to collect on it? What's the state going to do with this stuff? I mean, I guess you could send it out to a private mm-hmm. auction.
Well, and that's exactly what happens. Mr. Chair, that is what happens. And in the meantime, DAS has to have a place for storage of that because the debtor has an opportunity to redeem and buy it back. So there's a waiting period. It has to be stored. It goes to auction literally at the county courthouse. It's a pretty in-depth. I mean, that's pretty much.
Just follow up, Madam Pritcher. At what financial owing would we decide to go that route? I mean, I imagine we're not going to do it for $1,000.
Mr. Co-Chair, it's a case-by-case determination. We always issue the distraint warrant. It's an automatic letter now. But what we do is the agent will decide whether to record it. And if we have identified that there's unencumbered property, like maybe a combine or something that has already, the lien holder has been satisfied, something big, uh-huh. we will do that. But it's not very often for those reasons. Now, the real property we record regularly.
You know what's interesting? Sorry, Madam Critter, but in all of my financial lending, and I've done millions and millions and millions of dollars, I've never, ever seen a Department of Revenue lien on a credit check or on a UCC search. Ever. Ever. And I mean, I've done millions of dollars.
Mr. Co-Chair, they generally show up in the judgments area of the credit report. They're not up in
I've just never seen one. Anyway.
You have good clients then.
That is true. That is true.
Okay, so I think I left off with step four.
I'm sorry, Ms. Maxenter, what's it?
That's a good point. Thank you. Can we just talk a little bit more about how you establish a delinquent date? Often in the private sector, if the bill's not paid on the 15th, it's overdue on the 16th, and there's no 30-day. And it's my understanding that if I don't pay my income taxes, Oregon income taxes, on the 15th of April, if you don't have it, it's overdue on the 16th.
Correct.
So how do you decide the delinquent date on your personal income tax and also on your other agency accounts?
Okay, so Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, there's two completely separate questions in there. If I can answer the tax question first. Well, actually, I'll answer the OAA question first, because it can't even be assigned to us until the agency, the underlying agency, has its liquid. So that isn't an issue for us. For our tax debt, we have to let it age for a little while for it to become liquid. And at the time that a debt is assessed under Chapter 314, there is a lien under the law that's established. So that is the point that it is liquid and delinquent for us. Then in the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, there is a period of time where we must wait to issue a demand. The Taxpayer Bill of Rights requires us to issue a notice and demand for payment and give the taxpayer 30 days to pay it before we can start collecting on it. It is delinquent the next day for interest purposes, for all of those purposes on April 16th, if the due date is April 15th. It isn't under the OAM, the Oregon Accounting Manual, liquid and delinquent until other criteria has been met. And that's the criteria we use for collection purposes. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
I want to follow up because I think Senator Witz had asked a good question. If I hear you right, this is one of those problems with jargon. It sounds as if delinquent has two entirely different meanings.
Correct.
In this context, right? There's delinquent in the sense that if you don't pay your taxes by April 15th, you're delinquent in paying your taxes, and you can start getting interest assessed, as you just said. And it's delinquent in every sense that most of us outside the tax world think of it. But in terms of the collection piece of it, until all this other stuff has happened, mm-hmm. it's not delinquent.
That's correct.
In terms of what you can do to collect it.
That's correct. And those guidelines are outlined in the
Oregon Accounting Manual. It would be so nice for those of us in the real world if you could have different words for this stuff. So Senator Whitsitt and then Co-Chair Smith.
Give me a specific example. Last year, I sent in my personal income tax to the department, and
thank you.
You're welcome. You know how much. It was probably 30 or 45 days later. I got a request for interest payment because it was late. I happened to have a signed receipt that said that it wasn't late, and I called, and that was taken care of. So, okay. But the point is that it was late on the 16th of April, according to the Department of Revenue, but it was probably the 30th of May, the first week in June, before I got a notice. Why?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, we process 1.9 million returns, and a good portion of them, almost I think 17 or 18% of them, still are paper returns, and we have to manually go through those. We did have some issues. If you send a document certified mail right at the due date with the closure of the post office here in Salem, we did have some delays in mail is getting routed across in different places.
Yeah, of course, the date's on the receipt, but that's
right.
Really not the question. The question is what, why about 30 or 45 days before I got a notice?
It takes Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, it takes us a while to process those returns. We just have to get through them all, and then we send, I believe, about 30 days after the due date of the return, we send a courtesy notice if there has been an unpaid balance. And in that case, the system would have calculated an unpaid balance of interest, and we would have sent a billing notice. And it is, unfortunately, it's just a timing issue when you send returns in right at the due date of the return. It does happen a lot, and we'd like to not have it happen as much as it does.
So it's a lack of incremental staffing at the time, capacity.
Well, it's a combination of things. It's the mailing system, the fact that it takes so long to get there. We have some edits in the system to allow for the mailing system. We've changed that this year when we learned that there was delays in mails getting to us and checks getting to us. So there's a combination of things that can cause that.
And that was when the mail was going to DAS and then was being channeled to you later?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think so. I'm not exactly sure why it would go to DAS. But
I wasn't sure why it was either, but I believe when I tried to figure out what happened and with my particular return, it was I was told that it was that you didn't get the department
right.
didn't get the return until later because it had been hung up in the post office and
right.
through the DAS mail system.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, I I think this was attributable to the closing of the Salem post office. The mail was routed outside of the Salem area, and so it took longer to get to us. And so typically we have a handful of folks that fall into your situation every year where the timing is just right. That year we had several more folks because of the closing. We were told that it wouldn't impact the our business at all, but we found that it did have an impact on our business.
Mm-hmm. So if I could follow up one more time, is there a, that was sort of a one-time thing then, so if I were to run into the same situation this year, I would get a notice much sooner than 45 days?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, the amount of time it takes us to process the 1.9 million returns, it may or may not take as long. You might not get the notice because we'll have adjusted for the timing it took us to get there, so we wouldn't have assessed the interest. That would have just resolved itself behind the scenes. But we still have a 45-day window where we have to process 1.9 million returns, and we do that as quickly as we can before we have to start paying interest on refunds. So it's just it's the nature of the volume that we have to handle.
Okay. Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, before you ask your question, which I want you to do, folks, we are at 155. We're on slide 4 of 20. Mr. Buchholz and Ms. Mack and Mr. Bouchard have been very patient about being rescheduled and coming in on multiple occasions. I'm reluctant to ask them to come back again, but I'm also reluctant to limit questions because I think we're dealing with some important issues here. My suggestion at this point is that, Mr. Co-Chair, you ask your question, and then, folks, we try to let them get through a couple more slides if we can at least. And Ms. Mack and Mr. Buchholz and Mr. Bouchard, whenever you're going to come up, you figure out, prioritize the remaining slides. And then if we end up needing you to have another conversation, I think we may have some other stuff coming up down the road. So I think that's how I'd like to manage it, if that works for everybody. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. It's hard running that gavel when you're on slide 4 of 20.
Yeah, an hour into the thing, yeah.
Thank you for allowing one more offbeat question. By the way, thank you for being here. It's not fun sitting there being badgered by us, but these are important questions, mm-hmm. and I think some of the questions you're hearing today are just what the average taxpayer wants to know, mm-hmm. Some of these questions. My question is at what point does, and if I use the wrong terminology, forgive me, but at what point does a delinquency become a public record?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Representative Smith, I'm going to get this down.
Ms. Mack, I'm going to give you dispensation for the rest of the meeting. Just answer questions.
Thank you.
Don't worry about the protocol. It just takes time.
Okay, that's great. It becomes a public record when we record the debt in the county records.
Okay, so at that point in time, does a lender have the ability to get a hold of the Department of Revenue and say, I would like to inquire about Gregory Smith and Company? How do I, as a creditor, have the ability to find out if my potential borrower owes the state of Oregon money?
Mr. Co-Chair, it would be in the credit report. It would show up in the judgment area if we've recorded it, and that's when it becomes public record. So if you have pulled credit reports and you haven't seen it, the credit bureaus do come out and pull that data from the counties.
But it's not.
It shows up as a tax.
Does a commercial lender have an avenue to get a hold of the Department of Revenue and ask that question?
I think that they probably could come and ask us that. It would take some time to find out what lien or to look at the taxpayer to see if they've been recorded.
Currently, what we're doing is we're and I don't want to waste a ton of time here, but currently what we're doing is having them sign mm-hmm. a power of attorney prior to the lending. That allows us to verify in the future after a loan is made. My question is how do I verify it beforehand other than on a credit report? Because they don't always appear on there.
Do you want to?
Madam
Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, about 6 weeks ago, I asked, or it was actually right after phase one, I asked our program staff to identify options for you for this particular question, because this question came up in phase one.
Yeah.
In we sent that to you, and it may not have gotten
past
your...
I apologize, Madam Co-Chair. We're going to move on, and then why don't you and I... Let's visit more about this. I don't want to use committee's time.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Slide five.
On this slide here, step four is a notice of intent to offset. And the reason we issue that, that's about 120 days after the assessment. We do that so that we can seize a federal tax refund. And we can issue that as soon as the day that after the warrant has been issued. So our next slide here just outlines the statutory tools that I'm going to talk about that you've already given us. The payment plan, the first one, it's contained in the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. The taxpayer can set it up online, and for personal income tax, it's automatic if they can pay up to within 12 months. There are extended payment plans available if there are extenuating circumstances, and we do encourage staff to work with their managers and the taxpayers to identify situations like unemployment or a balloon payment kind of solutions. Active collections occurs generally when taxpayers either don't engage with us, don't respond to our phone calls, because our first step is to actually call them and reach out to them after we send those letters. Or they have broken a payment plan, promised payment plan. So that's when we start actively collecting, and that's when we start issuing notices of garnishment. Now, there's a notice of garnishment actually acts to seize 100% of the asset that is in the possession, custody, and control of the garnishee. If it's wages, they're automatically exempt from garnishment by 75%, so the debtor gets to keep 75% of their wages. We only can take 25%. So you'll often hear us talk about a wage garnishment and a bank garnishment. There's only one notice of garnishment, but we automatically just consider the wage with the exemption automatically. Bank garnishment can seize all of the contents of a bank account unless the bank can identify that it's protected from garnishment, such as Social Security or disability. They don't even send it to us. They just send us what is eligible to be garnished. That was a piece of legislation that was very effective in 2009 that you gave us, and we're happy with that because fewer challenges to say you took money you weren't entitled to. We issue about 100,000 garnishments a year agency-wide between bank garnishments and wage garnishments. No questions on that. Okay. So the Treasury Offset Program and the state is the state income tax levy program. We call it TOP. You've heard people talk about that. And there's also CITLIP, the state income tax levy program. It's reciprocal between the federal and the state programs. You have to participate in the state program in order to participate in the federal program. And what this does is it allows us to take a federal tax refund and apply it to the state tax debt. Now, the CITLIP, that is for the IRS to take the state tax refund and send it to pay the federal tax debt. For federal tax refund offset, in 2014, we received $12.5 million from about 25,000 liabilities just from federal tax refund offset. And we get quite a few payments from the notice of intent to offset. As soon as they see that, you're going to take my federal refund, they send us a payment. For the state side of it, we have sent to the IRS about $2 million on 4,000 accounts. So you can see there's way more bang for our buck on participating with the federal government than sending the money up to the feds. So the state reciprocal program, I think there's a typo on the slide there. It's actually SRP, state reciprocal program, and it's also known as federal vendor offset. In 2011, the legislature authorized the DOR to enter into agreement with the federal government to expand the TOP program beyond just tax debt offset. So it will include federal vendor payments. So any payment that is owed to a debtor in Oregon that is non-tax payments, if they are under contract with the federal government, then we can seize that and apply that to their debt that they owe us. We are currently working on programming that tool in our Gentex system. When the bill was passed in 2011, that's what we committed to doing. We said we weren't going to put this in place right now, but we will if we get the core system, and we are doing that now. We are working with DAS on a statewide approach to vendor offset so that all the agencies can talk to each other and all the debtors for the state can be worked through one funnel up to the federal government. The last component on this slide is referral to a private collection firm. state agencies are required to send their debt either to our other agency accounts program or a private collection firm if the debt has had 90 days pass with zero, with no payments. So they have to choose one or the other. So for the tax side of the department, we have 1 year cycle. The DOR has an exception in the statute to have 1 year from that instead of 90 days like the rest of the state agencies. So we do turn over the state debt over to private collection firms for sooner than that. We always do it usually after the 1 year has expired no payments. But we also consider debt for private collection firms earlier than that for certain circumstances if we know that the private collection firm is better at collecting the debt. For example, debtors that are out of state, they're much more effective at collecting on them than we are. Debtors with an account that's already at a private collection firm will just automatically send the next liability to the private collection firm. If it's a small balance, it's not worth having an agent actually going, you know, sending it out to the field to have an advanced collection tool used. We'll do that for private collection firms. So we do use them in partnership with as another tool for how we collect our debt. Any questions on that slide so far?
Sorry, Representative Nathanson.
Oh, thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I missed a little bit of what you said while I was looking at a couple of slides here, but is there an issue with what Department of Revenue employees can do, what you can look at, what you can try to enforce versus Department of Justice, and are permissions to either use information or disclosure law problems, that some things that impact your ability to do the work the same way that Department of Justice can take actions?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, I'm not sure what Department of Justice for child support purposes?
No, just it generally on compliance and collections and enforcement type activities.
Generally, the state agencies follow the Oregon Accounting Manual that's provided by DAS. It's a statewide policy. And we also subject ourselves, we all follow the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, so we all follow those same rules. I know with child support, they have some special rules about, they have new hire reporting at the federal level, so when a new employee comes in, they can they have to report within a certain number of days that they're on the books so that the Child Support Department can issue an order to withhold. We don't have that authority. So there are some differences in the authorities that the agencies have based on the type of debt that we're collecting, but I don't know that they're substantial or that there's okay. issues with them.
Thank you.
Representative Taylor?
I was trying to understand, thank you, Chair Senator Hayward. I was trying to understand why the waiting the 1 year when we know that if you wait a longer period of time for the private collections.
That's a very good question. For the tax debt, mm-hmm. we wait 1 full year for the refund offset cycle to pass because it's an annual tax return. So we wait to see if we can get a tax refund offset, and usually that does help us with that. But otherwise, we just send it, and we don't necessarily wait the full year. We'll send it if we think that that's the best place for it to go.
Follow-up? Thank you. I guess this would be a perfect example that if we see someone who's repeatedly not paying, then I guess I would like to see a different policy for someone who's repeatedly not paying, because then waiting a year doesn't seem to really make lot of sense to
well, Madam Chair and Representative Taylor, we don't wait. We don't just sit on it and not do anything. We try look for garnishment sources. We go out to the location. We look for sources of income. We have the ability to issue an administrative garnishment, a notice of garnishment, and the private collection firms don't. So we use the private collection firms in tandem with what we can do. We don't just automatically send everything to them. We do an evaluation of what debt is going to be most effectively collected at either DOR or at the private collection firm.
Okay.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. So the private collection firms get an account generally that's 1 year old from somebody that you're unable to contact or that's out of state, that has no address, or a very small balance. Wondering surprised they don't do very well. So I would wonder, have you ever done a study? Has the Department of Revenue ever done a study where you gave the private collectors a opportunity at the same level that you do to collect the money and see how they do?
Do you want to
speak
to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we did. but the study that we did was flawed. And I don't get all of the nuances of how you construct a study like that, mm-hmm. but our research section told us that what we were asking them was very difficult to do without having it be flawed in some way. I had asked them, this was 2 years ago, a little bit more than 2 years ago now, to find a way to do it anyway, to get this head-to-head. Because, I mean, that's going to give us one piece of information, right? It's going to tell us at least who collects it for a cheaper amount. But I also asked them to not do it after we got approval for the new system. Because what I didn't want to do is have us do a study to find out how our old tools fared against the private collection firms. I think that once we get our new tools in with Gentax, then that'll be the time to do that study and have that piece of information for us. Because it's not going to help us to know how much better we would have been or how much better they would have been 2 years ago.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, it's very difficult for us to do that because the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act doesn't allow us to collect in tandem on the same taxpayer. So we have to
say that again, please.
We can't, Department of Revenue can't collect on a taxpayer, and the private collection firm can't collect on the same taxpayer at the same time. The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act doesn't allow us to do that. So
that's a federal law or state law?
Federal law. And so we can't be tag teaming them like that. So the data that we're going to do, we're going to have to send separate sets of taxpayers, and they have separate behavioral issues. They have separate likelihood to pay. So that's the flaw in the study that we found. It's difficult for us to identify for that reason. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but as a researcher, I'm not totally convinced I agree that it's as hard as people are saying it is. But, I mean, I do randomized controlled trials, or I've participated in, or I've read certainly more than my fair share of them. Mm-hmm. So we could have a separate conversation at some point if you wanted to about it, but that's not a topic for today's meeting.
Madam Chair, we will try again.
Yeah, we will.
We will try again. Once we get our new tools, we'll try to put something together so we can at least have that piece. There are many other pieces to it other than who can collect it for the cheapest.
Yeah. No. We understand all that, Mr. Buchholz. We're not jumping on you. We're just trying
allies.
No,
I didn't mean to.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So next slide. This is when we get into some of the more advanced collection activities that we have. Okay. And this is mostly generally what you would consider seizure. We can go to a business and we can seize the cash from their till or their safe if they have one on premise. We call those till taps. We can seize vehicles or unlock safe deposit boxes. We don't do vehicle seizures too terribly often because there's often a lien on them, but we did just do one in 2014 and sold it for $13,000. We did drill some safe deposit boxes in 2014, and we have the stock sales component has been actually lucrative. We did 8 stock sales in 2014 and received $250,000 from those stock sales.
Nice. Senator Johnson.
Do you sell through the Department of Administrative Services?
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, yes, we do through, I believe it goes through the through DAS, and it goes through the state sheriff, or the county sheriff, excuse me.
And does the Department of Administrative Services take an administrative rake off the proceeds?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, I do not believe they do. I think that we have, it's not through state surplus in that sense. It goes through the county sheriff. I believe they charge, I want to say $47, something along those lines.
Okay, $47 I can live with. DAS at 1.1 at 25%.
I don't think
I sold a train through DAS, and that was an unusual commission.
Okay. Moving right along.
Okay. So, and then lastly, one of the tools that
we have is
license suspension, and we actually use this one very judiciously, as it's really, truly, the taxpayer is not coming to the table to talk to us. They aren't working with us. It's a last-ditch effort, and we often get payment from them when we send them a letter that says, look, we're going to suspend your license if you don't come to the table. And so that's been pretty effective. We don't use it very often because it is a pretty heavy hammer. So next tool we have are settlement offers, and this is where we can you hear the federal government, they call it an offer and compromise. The taxpayer can come to us and say, look, I can't make this, I'll never be able to pay this off. Here's what I can afford. They make a payment, a down payment, 5% of what they think they can afford. We do an evaluation, and we often will, there's a future compliance requirement, but after that period has expired, we'll just abate the debt that they owed under this. So there's some criteria. They can't be in bankruptcy or litigation. There's some simple stuff like that. But once they meet the terms of the agreement, then we'll just cancel what they otherwise have no ability to pay.
Okay, hang tight. Sarah Johnson's got other questions.
How standardized are the criteria? That seems sort of subjective.
Madam,
I'm just trying to ascertain, are all taxpayers treated equally?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, they are. We have an administrative rule that puts the criteria out there. It's 150305.155, I believe. There you go.
We're impressed, Ms. Mack.
Right there. I just happened to be looking at it. Thank you.
Okay, so I know that just in the interest of time, I'll kind of briefly go over this slide here. Write-off is a tool that you hear a lot about, and cancellation is a tool you hear a lot about, and people get confused about the difference. Write-off, for lack of a better term, is we put it into a holding bucket if there are these criteria on the slide and the red bar are met. So we sit on it and we wait for something. It can be restored. We can collect on it again if we identify an asset later. It can come out of the holding bucket. Cancellation is a legal term, and it is forever extinguished. Once we cancel a debt, we can't reinstate it later if it becomes if we find an asset down, you know, 10 years down the road. And this is the category where we find the ability to pay, or we work with taxpayers on settlement. If the debt is wholly uncollectible, we'll cancel the debt because of the cost to collect for us. It doesn't pencil out. Then you can see the amounts on there.
But that, just to clarify, those amounts are annual? Those are over a biennium? Those are what, 75.1?
Madam Chair, that was an annual number, but remember, we hadn't done it in several years. We were focused on collections. It takes our experienced collectors to be able to look at this debt, and so it takes them out of doing their actual collections, and because the state was in a position where we needed dollars more than we needed folks looking at canceling debt, we hadn't done it in several years.
So the last column over there is the abatement, and that's where taxpayers file true returns in response to a filing enforcement action. We reconcile it when they win an appeal. If we have a legal issue, it's outstanding, we'll abate. We'll also, taxpayers can voluntarily amend their return, and we'll adjust it to reduce it. So that's an abatement. And then we also look at penalty waivers as a tool to help them come into compliance. We'll waive their penalty if they'll pay or file or whatever it is we can do to get their agreement.
Sorry, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. If there's going to be a future slide on this, tell me. I want to talk briefly about the taxpayer that just simply lies. Simply just lies, you know, and says they've got 7 kids when they only have 3, and they claim the house mortgage deduction, and, you know, I mean, yet the person who lies, what do we do with them?
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Smith, we have, that's what our audit function is for, and that's what, there's some consistency checks that go through the federal e-file process.
I get all that. I want to talk punishment side.
Okay, on the penalty side, there are penalties for failure to pay. They're all the penalties you have on tax law have some sort of a hybrid related to a failure to pay. So if there's tax fraud on refunds, like refundable credits, and they still get a refund, there is no consequence. However, there is a consequence if there is an amount owing. So it can be as high as 100%.
Let's just say I'm just the dirtiest dog, and on my return, I file a return, right, and I am who I say I am, but I just plain lie throughout the return.
Right. The maximum penalty for fraud is 100% of the tax that was shown as underreported on the tax that's still outstanding on the return.
I'm not going to jail, though.
It is a crime to evade tax, but there are some constraints with the criminal law, because the way that it's theft from the state, in order for it to be aggravated theft, you have to have a certain dollar amount over a certain window of time, and so DOJ finds it difficult to prosecute those cases because of the way it amounts to something that's has a return on their it costs too much for the amount of tax involved. Does that make sense?
It does.
So there's not a lot of outright criminal.
And yeah, we don't think there's any deterrent effect.
Not that I've seen so far, yeah.
So you're just going to become their partner for a long time.
We are partners with some of them for a very long time, and we're looking at tools that we can use to to put this out there and try and I know Senator Johnson was a fan of this. She mentioned it last time about publishing delinquent debtors online, and that is something that we're considering because some of these people can't be criminally prosecuted, and so there's no really other tool for it. But yeah, that's one of the things we're looking at.
Okay.
And there was no slide on that, so.
Oh, was there?
There was no slide.
Okay.
So, I don't know what my time limits are here. So the next slide, I'm going to go ahead and talk about. I just skipped a couple. Do you want me to go over the legislative stuff?
I don't think so.
Okay. Then I will step aside and I will give my chair to Steve.
Okay. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Steve Bouchard. I'm the section manager for collection section, specifically for personal income tax. And if I'm understanding right, I perhaps prioritize what I brought to share, do my best, and field questions.
Let me drive.
I was asked to prepare a few initiatives and important events of change that we've went through in collection section. So I'd like to name a few of those. I came to the section approximately 1 year ago, and so one of the first initiatives was to eliminate vacancy and be fully staffed, and over a year ago we had 12-14 vacant positions for the collections, and today we have zero. So we have fully staffed our collection section, and we've gone through intensive training and redesigning of our training program to get people the most efficient they can be, and at this point we're fully functional and fully staffed. One of the drivers in that is the recognition that the debt that gets to collections, and so in my world I look at a $660 million AR, that's what's in my plate for collections. That work comes in cyclical. As a result of filing season, by the time the fall comes around, we get a large volume of debt. And it's been known that the department struggles to address that debt quickly, and it's also been understood that the fresh debt, approaching fresh debt the soonest, provides the most net gain. So we redesigned our method to address that debt annually, and we started this last fall in August by realigning all of our staff to be able to deal with brand new debt. In the past, we had, to use round numbers, if we had 100 collectors, many of them, almost half of them, were assigned to just take incoming phone calls, and the others were assigned to work on queue and work outbound traffic and work garnishment and do research. And so it was very hard at that time of year to take all the incoming phone calls effectively. And so essentially what I'm saying is now the entire section all share the duties, and the workload has been shared, and we have... as a benefit, as a noted benefit of that, we have reduced our call wait times from an average of 19 minutes to less than 6 minutes today, and we're answering 87% of our incoming phone calls versus 61% 18 months ago, and it had been worse than that in the past. So we're seeing a gain in that process of redesigning how our work has flowed. There was a report generated by our research department not long ago that you all read. And that report gave us a lot of information about the debt that's in the AR, and it allowed us to ask a lot more questions, and the research department was gracious enough to do a little bit more work so that we could kind of slice and dice the entire AR and provide agents and our management team more information about the makeup of the AR. We were able to segregate and review all this debt in our inventory that wasn't necessarily flagged for write-off or cancellation because it met some criteria. However, it may have been sitting there in a work queue, not being actively worked. So we've spent a lot of time and doing collections and write-off work as a result. We reviewed balances to assign work to maybe more skilled collectors than it had been assigned to in the past. So it took a lot of work that was maybe perhaps sitting idle in a collector's queue, not being effectively collected on because we learned so much about it that we could get it to an advanced level collector sooner than we could in the past through more of a manual process.
2 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's hard for me to decide what might be most important to you. I think what I'll share is the fact that we're going through a core systems replacement. I have some information that we're looking forward to gain as a result. We anticipate with the development of the data warehouse and the reporting tools, we'll be able to measure the efficacy of everything that we do in a whole different way. And so there'll be analytics for recognizing debtor characteristics. There'll be analytics to determine where an account is in the collections process and what would be the best treatment for it. There's three key ways that I see the proper use of this analytics. One is to assign the work, one is to determine debtor characteristics, and the other is to track the progress of the account. And we're working with Gentex now to develop criteria and design that up front, and it will be an ongoing process because the Gentex tool, as time goes on and as things happen with an account or with an individual or with a taxpayer, the system recognizes all the activities and will help us flag information that we can make better decisions on.
And Mr. Bouchard, when do you think you're going to start to have a sense of how effective these changes have been or are being?
With the Gentex?
No, even the stuff you're already doing.
Oh, well, I think there's we've had a lot of wonderful results already this year. For example, I told you that we changed the process of addressing new debt. In the years past, what I discovered was when the new debt showed up for the prior year's tax assessments, we would start working on it August, September. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, new debt was still untouched by March, April, May, or even later. By making that change last year, we were able to work, address, create correspondence to every one of those accounts before December ended.
That's impressive.
Yeah, and I think that makes a huge difference. Along with the fact that I told you that we had people that did one skill set, and so they took inbound phone calls, and we had a group of people that did not take inbound phone calls. And I think what that told me was the opportunity to not miss a phone call by changing that whole process. And our call activity has greatly increased. And specifically, we used to make 6,500 outbound phone calls a month, and now we make over 11,000. And we have a very, very high rate of answered phone calls.
Cool. Okay. Excellent. Okay.
So I'm not sure.
Yeah. What do we have? We have like two minutes, right?
Yeah, about that.
Okay. Let me, can I just cut to the last?
Yes, please do. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Nathanson, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's really fascinating to hear how the number of phone calls has changed. But that's what I normally call an activity measure, not a performance measure. So I'm wondering, what is that outcome? So a lot more calls coming in, being answered more quickly, a lot more calls going out, but toward what end? What has improved or deteriorated or changed as a result?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Nathanson, one correlation I would make to that is total revenue collected for the biennium. Currently, at the end of March, we are just about $260 million total collections, with a pace or rate of nearly $302 million as a forecast at the end of the biennium. That's a 9% gain over last year and a 15% gain over the biennium prior to that. And I meant not over last year, but the 11-13 biennium and a 14% gain over the 9-13 biennium.
So the good news is you're doing that. The bad news is that's making the kicker bigger. Okay. Co-Chair Smith, you want to?
Quick one.
Okay.
Quick
All
question.
Right.
So can you just briefly talk to us about the tool that is the partnership we have with the Internal Revenue Service and their auditing staff? I would assume one of the best tools we have is a partnership with the IRS as they do their audits and the sharing of information.
Mm-hmm. Let me take that. Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, you're right, and we do share audits with them, but if you recall last time when we testified, the cuts to the IRS budget has caused their work that they're sending our way to drop off the table.
Would you classify the relationship decline with the IRS as excellent, good, adequate, poor, bad? I mean, how would you describe
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, it's excellent. We have a fantastic relationship with the IRS.
Perfect. Thank you.
Have had for years.
Okay.
Okay.
Please.
Madam Co-Chair, I was also going to add We're looking for efficiencies in any way that we can up until Gentex comes, regardless of Gentex coming.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to mention that along with Gentex, we're trying and working towards taxpayer self-sufficiency, gaining efficiencies with that so that individuals can either use online tools, use our web service, or use what we'll be calling revenue online with Gentex to perhaps eliminate the need to phone us. When they can find an answer online and complete their payment process right online. And we're doing many things to get to that point to make the experience better for the taxpayer overall and moreover, help them get to voluntary compliance on their own.
Okay. Mr. Buelholz, I'm going to give you about 2 minutes to back clean up, and I'm sorry. This is a really important topic, and we know that you've gone over some of this material several times.
That's
but it's
right.
Obviously
I'll do it in less than that. I think the Reader's Digest version of how you can support us, how you can help us, is to continue to support us. We did our due diligence for the system. We called in several states that had gone down this road ahead of us, and we heard a couple of universal themes. One was that when you flip the switch to the new system, you're going to be able to find and bill a lot more of these accounts than you have been able to in the past. And you're also going to be able to collect a lot more. And so what they told us is that tends to increase constituent complaints. And so what I would ask of you is to have our backs, that as folks come to you with these complaints, that you help them to understand that we're doing exactly what you've asked us to do.
Can I just say something about that, though, please? We're here. There's seven of us, some number. good thing I'm not doing your job.
And a half.
We've got 83 other colleagues out there, and I hope that before you flip that switch, you give all of us some notice that it's going to happen and tell them what you told us and tell them that we've got your backs and you've been talking to us about this for years and we know about it, but you need them to know
about
it,
too. Madam Chair, we'll do that.
Thank you. I appreciate that because that will make your lives easier and then you won't hear from people who don't know.
Great.
Thank you.
Right. The other thing I would say that we heard that was pretty universal is that after about a year of using the new system, you're going to identify opportunities for investment.
Okay.
And what I'm talking about here is where additional staff might help us in the increased volume of work. And so we'll make a commitment to you to bring those back to you after we've had a year in the new system, and we just ask for your consideration of those.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, you get the last word.
Before we end this, you said what else we can do to support you. I would like to publicly support you to do whatever you can to keep Deanna Mack. We have teased in our office up in Scappoose where we handle a lot of constituent stuff. She's listed in our database as goddess of fixing things.
But just so you know, that's my chief of staff back there talking to Ms. Mack about one of my constituent problems. So you could not be more timely, Senator.
Fair enough. We love Deanna, too.
So that's good to know. Okay. Thank you all. We appreciate both the work you're doing back at the ranch and your patience with us as we try to dig into this and figure out how to not pound you into the ground, but rather support you, understand this better, figure out what tools we can help you with to make sure that the state's getting the revenue it needs. I don't want to raise taxes if we've got money living on the table to support needed services. So. Okay, with that, I am closing the public hearing on House Bill 5035, and we're adjourned. Thank you all very much. Bill 5035, and we're adjourned. Thank you all very much. Hearing on House